This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 25th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Nicaragua has been very much in the news lately. Many of you will remember, some I suspect with fond memories, the Sandinista revolution in that country 40 years ago and the U.S. efforts under President Reagan to violently overturn it. It was an issue that engaged a sufficient number of the American public that a nationwide phone campaign by U.S. supporters of the Sandinistas was able to bring about a congressional resolution cutting off U.S. funds to the administration-backed Contras, something that is difficult to imagine happening today. Consequently, the reports of ongoing street protests across the Nicaraguan countryside and the widespread demands for the resignation of President Daniel Ortega in the wake of his government's brutal response to the protests has been both troubling and confusing for those still having some emotional stake in the Nicaraguan revolution. Along with the situation in Syria and Venezuela, the issue has caused serious divisions in what was once considered the left here in the United States. Some old-timers who were once active in supporting the Sandinistas view all the troubles there as the latest attempt by Washington to establish a puppet government in Managua. Others see the situation as one in which the Sandino legacy has long been abandoned and the Nicaraguan people are simply responding to the increasingly dictatorial powers of President Ortega and his wife Rosario Murillo, who happens to be the country's vice president and a powerful figure in her own right. Rebecca Gordon, who teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco and lived for a time in Nicaragua, is one of the latter. I'll be speaking with her about the situation there in her recent article for Times Dispatch entitled Nicaragua at the Barricades and a Crossroads at 20 minutes past the hour, so please stay tuned for that. The current issue of Time magazine features a remarkable computer-generated portrait that combines the faces of President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, and as one has come to expect, a feature article on the inside offering a further analysis of the summit meeting between the two men last week in Helsinki. As with what appears to be every other mainstream media outlet these days, the criticism of Russia as a military aggressor, as an existential threat, and our democracy has been relentless. Not an hour can go by without an NPR host interviewing a former U.S. diplomat or general about the danger from Russia, and while there are dissenters out there who are not paid Russian propagandists in the current atmosphere, you will neither read nor hear what they have to say. One might argue that the gerrymandering of congressional districts, the arbitrary purging by Republican state officials of thousands of black and brown voters from the voting rolls going back to the 2000 elections, where it made the difference in Florida and put Bush in the White House, you remember that, their ongoing efforts to make it more difficult for the elderly and poor to even register to vote, and the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that removed all limits to corporate campaign financing, have done more to undermine what was left of our democracy than any Russian, President Putin, or group of Russians huddling behind their computers could hope to do. To understand Trump's actions is another story. I am not one to credit him with doing anything that doesn't primarily benefit himself. The notion that Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un and Putin reflects his concern for world peace and harmony among nations is simply non-credible and lead me to the conclusion, shared by others, that Trump had a number of dealings with Russian businessmen and financiers who are close to Putin and to whom he owns a debt. There is, however, a separate issue from what we. This is, however, a separate issue from what we're told to believe, without being shown the evidence that Russia's so-called meddling was responsible for putting Trump in the White House. There was another election meddling which led to a Time magazine cover, which strangely has been absent from the current discussion, which I mentioned on an earlier program. It was from July 1996 and had the face of a smiling Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, on the cover, with an American flag pin on his label, on his lapel, and with good reason, as accompanying headline promised, "The Secret Behind Yeltsin Win." On opening the magazine, the reader found a story by Martin Kramer, Time's Moscow correspondent, headlined "Rescuing Boris, the Secret Story of How Four U.S. Advisors Used Polls, Focus Groups, Negative Ads, and All the Other Techniques of American Campaigning to Help Boris Yeltsin Win." It described how American Republican political operatives who had previously worked for California Governor Pete Wilson had gone to Russia to rescue his bid for re-election when polls indicated the Communist Party might return to power. The outcome was by no means inevitable, wrote Kramer. The past winter, Yeltsin's approval ratings were in the single digit. There are many reasons for his change in fortune, but a crucial one has remained a secret. For 4 months, a group of American political consultants clandestinely participated in guiding Yeltsin's campaign. Yeltsin's standing in the polls, wrote Kramer, was a reflection of his brutal misadventure in Chechnya, his increasing authoritarianism, and his economic reform program, which has brought about corruption and widespread suffering, end quote. Considering the country's deep dislike of Yeltsin and the communist surge in election in the Russian Duma in December 1995, Felix Brainin, a close friend of some of Yeltsin's top aides who immigrated to San Francisco, thought that something radical had to be done. According to Kramer's report, he began a series of confidential discussions with Yeltsin's first deputy prime minister, Oleg Soskovets, who was in charge of his reelection effort. In early February 1996, Brainin was instructed to, quote, find some Americans, but to proceed discreetly. Security and secrecy was paramount, said Brainin. Everyone realized that if the communists knew about this before the election, they would attack Yeltsin as an American tool. We barely needed the team, but having them was a big risk, end quote. Well, they turned out to be veterans of Pete Wilson's election campaign. They enlisted Richard Dresner, a New York-based consultant who had worked with them on many of Wilson's campaigns. Dresner had another connection that would prove useful later on, wrote Kramer. In the late 70s and early 80s, he had joined with Dick Morris to help Bill Clinton get elected in Arkansas as governor. As Clinton's current political guru at the time, Morris became the middleman on those few occasions when the Americans sought the administration's help in Yeltsin's reelection drive. So while Clinton was uninvolved personally with Yeltsin's recruitment of the American advisors, the administration knew of their existence. In late February, Dresner was in Moscow meeting Soskovets. "There's not much time," he said. "You're hired," Soskovets told Dresner. "I will tell the president that we have the Americans," end quote. And then Time magazine's Martin Kramer wrote, Soskovets ominously added a thought that would reverberate in early May. Alluding to Yeltsin's poor standing and the reluctance of his aides ever to yield power to the communists, Soskovets told Dresner, "One of your tasks is to advise us a month from the election about whether we should call it off if you determine that we're going to lose," end quote. To preserve security, a contract was drawn between the International Industrial Bank Incorporated of San Francisco, a company Felix Brainin managed for its Moscow parent, and Dresner Wickers, Dresner's consulting firm in Bedford Hills, New York. The Americans would work for 4 months beginning March 1st. They'd be paid $250,000 plus all expenses and have an unlimited budget for polling, focus groups, and other research. A week later, they were working full-time. When they started, Yeltsin's approval rating was about 6%, and Joseph Stalin had a higher positive rating in the polls. Yet Yeltsin defeated communist candidate Gennady Zyukhanov by more than 13 percentage points. One unfortunate result of that victory was the turning over to a handful of wealthy businessmen, now referred to as the oligarchs, the control of Russia's natural resources through a plan to finance as Yeltsin's campaign described as, quote, loans for shares. The loans were to Yeltsin, and when he couldn't pay them back, he held a private closed auction with his creditors, which resulted in what was arguably the greatest theft ever of the country's resources and a dozen new Russian billionaires. And it wouldn't have happened without American meddling. A month ago, you heard Robert Fisk of the Independent of London, long based in Beirut, discussing his visit to Syria to investigate reports that the Syrian government had used sarin gas on the residents of the town of Douma, which Fisk found no witnesses or evidence to support the claim. Earlier he had traveled to Aleppo after the bombing by Russian and Syrian aircraft had reduced much of the eastern part of that city to rubble. In the July 20th issue of The Independent, he wrote that in the basement of a bombed-out Al-Qaeda arms storage building in eastern Aleppo last year, he found a weapons logbook from a mortar factory in Bosnia with a handwritten name of one of its senior officials, Efet Kernjic, on each page. On the first page was a note indicating that a cargo of 500 to 120 millimeter mortars had been shipped January 2016 from the Balkans, so Fisk went searching for Efet Kernjic in the heart of central Bosnia, and he found him. According to Kernjick, his company sent the arms to Saudi Arabia. When Fisk showed him the logbook, Kernjick was quick to acknowledge that it was his signature on every page, and that Saudi officials and military personnel had come to the factory to inspect the mortars before their shipment to Riyadh, and that all such sales were strictly in accordance with the legal end-user certificates which his company obtained from all customers. These state that the weapons were to be used only by the armed forces of the nations which purchased them. 500 mortars is a massive amount of shipments. Most European armies don't have that many in their individual inventories, writes Fisk, and some of them at least appear to have ended up in the hands of Bashar al-Assad's Islamic Nusra Front al-Qaeda enemies in northern Syria within 6 months of their dispatch from Bosnia, 1,200 miles away. According to Fisk, the documents indicate the mortars must have reached Aleppo by late July 2016, when Syrian troops totally surrounded the enclave held by armed factions, including Nusra, ISIS, and other Islamic groups condemned as terrorists by the United States. Fisk recalls that in the last stages of the 2016 siege of Aleppo, Syrian and Russian forces were condemned in the West for the daily bombings of civilian areas of eastern Aleppo, and video footage provided constant images of dead and wounded men, women, and children. During this period, however, he writes, the city's Islamist defenders, most of whom later departed under a promise of safe passage for jihadi-held areas of Idlib province, fired barrages of mortar shells, these mortar shells, at government-held western Aleppo. If that was announced at all by the U.S. press, it was at the very end of the story. In another badly damaged building, lying half-concealed amid iron fragments and field dressings, Fisk found piles of discarded documents containing firing instructions for machine guns and mortars, all of them in English. In yet another building with the words Jaish al-Mujahideen, which means Army of the Holy Fighters, crudely painted but still visible on the front, he found dozens of empty boxes for anti-armor weapons, all marked with their maker's name, the Hughes Aircraft Company of California. The boxes were labeled, quote, guided missile surface attack, unquote, with stock numbers and the computer code clearly visible. You can find Robert Fisk's entire article on the Independence webpage. Israel has been an apartheid state since its inception. From its founding in 1948 to 1966, the 150,000 Palestinians remained after 750,000 had been ethnically cleansed were kept segregated in the Galilee under military control, and even when that was lifted, 97% of the country was restricted to Jews only. Since 1967, when Israel launched its war against Egypt and occupied the West Bank and Gaza, it has effectively controlled all the land and the air above it, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, with the Palestinians barred from living in Jewish settlements, barred from driving on the far superior Jewish-only roads, and subjected to scores of checkpoints. As far as back as the 1980s, South Africans as well as a number of Israeli journalists were calling it apartheid, although the best U.S. officials could do was warn Israel that if it did not make an accommodation for a Palestinian mini-state or Bantustan, it would inevitably become an apartheid state, as if it wasn't that already. The notion of creating a single democratic state with one person, one vote was, of course, out of the question. The world was told, would place the Jewish character of the state in jeopardy. Well, the character of the state became evident early Thursday morning when the Knesset, Israel's legislative body, passed by a 62-55 vote a piece of legislation making Israel the, quote, nation state of the Jewish people, unquote. The so-called nationality law enshrines in Israel's quasi-constitutional basic law that Israel is a nation state of the Jewish people. Much of the bill, sponsored by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party, deals with obvious signs that Israel is a Jewish state, such as affirming the symbols on the flag and shield, seeing a Hebrew calendar as the country's official calendar, recognizing Jewish holidays of days of remembrance, the national anthem, and naming Jerusalem as the capital, and also, of course, making Hebrew the official language. Netanyahu called the passing of the law a defining moment. What he said was, we enshrine in law the basic principle of our existence. Israel is a nation state of the Jewish people that respects the individual rights of all its citizens. This is our state, the Jewish state. In recent years, have been some who have attempted to undermine this, to undercut our very existence. Today, we made it a law. This is our nation, language, anthem, and flag, end quote. The chairman of the Arab Joinless Party, Ayman Odeh, said in a statement that Israel, quote, has declared it does not want us here, end quote, meaning its Arab citizens, and that, quote, we will always be second-class citizens, end quote. They represent one-fifth of the Israeli population, approximately 1.5 million, and are descendants of those who remained in 1948. And despite Israeli propaganda, they are treated as equals with all the same opportunities as Israeli Jews. It has never been true. Now the inequality is enshrined in Israeli law, and it could get about its business of telling the world what to do. Well, let's start in Syria, where the day before one of its U.S. Patriot missiles shot down a Russian-made Syrian jet over the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Netanyahu rejected the Russian proposal to help keep Iranian forces in Syria 100 kilometers or 62 miles from Israel's northern border, which it considers to be at the edge of the Golan Heights. That no country, including the U.S., up to this point recognizes the Golan as part of Israel has never meant anything, since its domestic lobbies in the U.S., as in the U.K., France, and Germany, hold their respective governments in thrall. Israel is also sticking to its demand of Moscow that Iran not be allowed any military foothold in Syria, that all long-range missiles be removed from the country, and that any factories producing precision-guided missiles there be closed. Additionally, Israel wants Moscow to guarantee that all air defense systems that protect the aforementioned arms will be removed from Syria. And lastly, Israel wants the border crossings between Syria and Lebanon and between Syria and Iraq closed to prevent Iranian weapons smuggling. This set of demands, which tramples on the sovereignty of three neighboring states, will put up the now tight relationship between Putin and Netanyahu to its stiffest test. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.